broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to The Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy.
Good morning and welcome to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio are my great companions, Brett Dickinson.
Hey, mate.
And Joel Hewish.
How are you, Louis?
Very well, thank you.
Hey, listeners, how are we?
Our other great companion is not so well today.
No, she's been crook for a while.
Yeah.
Young Steph. Mm, she's out there battling a pretty bad viral infection,
I think. That's what living with Joel will do.
Well, yeah. We had a nice weekend planned to go up to Daylesford last weekend, and we did, but we spent the whole day in the accommodation that we were staying.
Nothing worse than when you have a trip and you're sick.
And then I brought her in, and then we went down to the Epworth and dropped her in there on Sunday on the way home because she wasn't getting any better, and they put her on a drip for about an hour or so just to try and dose her up.
So
she's been off work all week, but she's starting to come good again, which is, I don't know if that's a good thing. I liked her when she was sedated. Yeah.
She's probably going to listen to this show. Yeah. Come on, be careful.
Sounds like she's been working pretty hard.
She has.
Might have run herself down a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've got to take better care of ourselves, people.
Mm.
Much better care.
It's been going around, though. We've had a few from this office away for a few days, haven't we?
Yeah,
so, you know, I thought we were at the end of winter, but there seems to be just that lingering bug that seems to be moving around.
Yeah, I reckon it's coming back every 2 or 3 months.
Yeah,
we had an awful June with staff in our office. We had an awful August, and now it's October, and same thing.
Mm. Yeah.
Lots of staff being off, so I don't know. It's not a flu and cold season anymore. Seems to be almost continuous.
Yesterday was 34 degrees. It got to.
Yeah, it was. Warm day.
We've turned the corner.
Yeah, we have. Mm. Thank goodness. Here comes summer. Wonderful. So let's kick into our show. Joel, you've previously been talking about initial price offerings and new companies coming to the market.
Yeah.
And you've put the boot in a few. and you want to give us an update on that today.
Yeah, it's just a continuation of this break in the IPO market, the initial public offering market, that seems to be going on, at least in the US and certainly here in Australia as well. So we've had, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a couple of further big failures to get off the ground with new IPOs in Australia coming to the market. Once again, a KKR-backed company, a property guru, estimated to be worth around about $1 billion, largely has, it's a real estate selling platform mainly focused on Asian markets. KKR, which is the private equity group out of the big behemoth out of the United States, has once again tried to bring another company to the Australian Stock Exchange and has failed. Mm-hmm. So that's on the back of the Latitude Financial failure that took place. We've also seen Bain Capital's Retail Zoo and Betty's Burgers and Boost Juice in the last couple of weeks. Yeah, that failed on Tuesday. So they, when we say they failed, essentially what has happened is that the brokers who are acting for these the sellers or trying to raise capital for these businesses have not been able to find enough interest at the price in which the vendors were satisfied with. So
they actually pull it, don't they? They don't actually try.
It
doesn't get to failure.
Well, they pull it because it is going to fail.
It's considered failure.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have been planning this for a long time, and this would be the timing, and to not realise it would be failure.
Yeah. Mm. So there's a real stink around these IPOs at the moment. Everyone's very sort of skeptical. Valuations are certainly quite high. The old model of put an IPO out there and sell the story is now broken, and ultimately I think that's a good thing for markets and their longevity, because it gets people starting to think about earnings and profits and long-term sustainable businesses rather than just hope and pray and this expectation that a company is going to transform the world. So, yeah, it's just a continuation. And I just wanted to also check in.
Joel, before you move on, I just want to touch on something. I've read about investment strategies, which is basically banking on the fact that IPOs on average increase by something like, I don't know if it's 10% or 20% or 30% on average in the first few months of their launch. Mm. So as an investment strategy, there's funds out there where they just buy every IPO.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is probably true. I mean, why would you want to invest in an IPO when you've got no long-term... Well, in most cases, you don't have a long-term history of audited financials. So you get into an IPO. Why? Because generally the pricing of IPOs are seen to be more favorable. The whole idea behind an IPO is this. You know, if you're an investment banker, you want to be able to distribute stock to your investors. And if you're an investment banker who wants to continue doing that, then you need to make sure that you're pricing these IPOs at a reasonable price, mm-hmm. where the investors who buy that stock see some short-term profits and have a chance to exit with a profit. Okay, so the problem is that a lot of these private equity IPOs that are coming to market, these are by very smart, sophisticated people. These are not by entrepreneurs who are selling businesses a lot of the time. These are not by entrepreneurs who are selling shares in a business to raise growth capital. Mm. And if they are, they're selling them at a really exorbitant price. And people have now, and they're burning their own investors. So people are now skeptical. Mm. And we spoke about Zoom and Beyond Meat that were priced at 80 times sales. Okay. Jeez. Remember, you're an investor in a stock for the profits, not for the sales.
Yeah.
Okay. And, and 80 times sales. Well, since we spoke about those 4 months ago, those two stocks are now down 35% on average in the last 4 months. Mm. So I just think this is actually quite a good thing, because if you are hoping for stronger, more sustainable share prices going forward, then some of the froth in this area of the market needs to come out. Otherwise, you run the risk of having a significantly severe correction later on down the track, like what we had in the dot-com days, where tech companies were selling on eyeballs on websites, not on any form of fundamental valuation. So that's one thing that's captured the headlines this week. I've also noted that the business confidence for small and medium-sized enterprises in Australia has bounced back. And this is interesting because there's been a lot of pundits out there suggesting that we're going to head into a recession. The Australian economy is going to head into a recession. Well, that seems to have turned on ahead, and we're now back at levels where we were at the start of this calendar year. So the second quarter of 2019 was a pretty poor quarter for sentiment. We obviously had the election. We had lots of concerns mm-hmm. around what policies might come into force should a Labor government get into play, and how that might flow onto real estate. Well, since then, it's been a complete reversal, and we're now seeing small and medium-sized enterprises start to gain confidence in business conditions. We've seen the real estate market start to bounce. So once again, I reiterate right here, I can't see a recession in Australia. It might be that we have softer economic conditions, but I don't think that we're seeing a recession anytime in the next little while. The other interesting point of news was the whipping boy from the Royal Commission. Clients have pulled out $1.9 billion from AMP.
Ooh.
And I've got to say, I was a little bit pissed off with AMP a couple of weeks ago and their new CEO, where he was quoted in the paper as saying, the problem with the Australian wealth management industry is that the industry doesn't care about putting their clients' interests first.
How could he say that?
Well, nobody.
You don't.
You guys don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
The industry.
That's the problem, you dickhead.
Yeah.
And that's why you're losing, almost $2 billion out of your business in just the last 18 months.
Wow.
So, there just seems to be this complete...
Talk about compounding yourself.
Yeah. Yes. So, anyway, that just rolled me up for the week. Yeah, dickhead.
Wow.
We'll leave it at that.
Don't force best interest obligations on us because it doesn't exist. What? Jeez. That's crazy.
Yeah, wow. So anyway.
There you go. Interesting stuff. Now, you also wanted to talk about something else, Joel. You'd learned something else during the week.
Yes. Well, we've heard of Occupy Wall Street back in 2011, coming out of the global financial crisis, that... This was where we had those protesters around the time of the recovery out of the global financial crisis that were campaigning against the inequality of wealth in the Western world. Mm.
The top 1% versus
the rest,
the 99%.
Yep. Well, unfortunately, none of that has worked. The top 1% have continued to get wealthier across most of the Western world. In fact, on average, it's around the top 1% are now 35% wealthier than what they were back in 2011. Some stats this week provide some insight into what it takes to be part of the 1%ers.
All right.
Across the different countries. So in the United States, and these are in US dollar figures, but I'll try and relay them back for Aussie dollars where appropriate. So in the United States, if you are earning over $515,000 per annum, you are considered to be part of the 1% group.
Okay. Okay, 515.
Now, if you want to be part of the top 0.01%, 0.1%.
Yep.
Then you would need to be earning about $2.4 million.
Mm.
In Australia, to be part of the 1%er group, now this is data in Australia that goes back to 2017. So I've been hunting around to see if there was any other more current figures, but it doesn't appear so.
That might have been the latest census or something.
Yeah, it must have been something around that. So in US dollars, it was $239,000 a year, which would convert into Aussie dollar terms at 68 cents in the dollar right now of around about $351,000.
Mm.
So if you're earning $351,000, that puts you in the 1%ers group. Now the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, has also put out some further stats in terms of what it looks like to be part of Australia's different classes in regards to your wealth. So they've broken it down into quintiles, which essentially breaks it down into fifths.
Mm-hmm.
And the top one-fifth of Australian households, they have an average net worth of $3.2 million.
Okay.
And a median net worth of $2.2 million.
All right.
Okay, they typically have money in the bank of around about $156,400. Their share portfolios typically average around about $138,700. They have private trusts, such as family trusts, that typically have a valuation of around about $192,500. And the value of their superannuation fund is around about $646,000.
Okay.
Most of them drive a car that would be worth around about, on average, $48,000 in today's market.
Right. There's a bit of a gap in those numbers, Joel. I presume the rest would be real estate. If the median is 2-point-something million.
Yep, so here we go.
You're getting to it?
Yep.
I'm jumping ahead?
Yep.
I'm too quick.
So then we've got the value of an owner-occupied home is on average $1.2 million.
Right.
The value of other property owned is around $628,500. Debt on their property is collectively worth on average around $270,000. Mm. Excuse me. So that's the top. Now, if we go down to, I'll just quickly run through the other quintiles. Excuse me. The average net worth is on the second quintile. So if you're in the top fourth, the second top fifth. Yep, that's it. Average net worth of $1.04 million and a median net worth of $1.03 million. If you're in the middle, so you've got average assets. You've got a net worth of around about $564,500 and a median net worth of about $558,800. If you're in the less wealthy...
So the fourth of the fifth.
That's it. You've got an average net worth of $231,000 and a median net worth of $223,000. And if you're in the least wealthy, your average net worth is... $35,200 or a median net worth of $31,500. So there we have it, right?
Mm.
We continue to see that the wealth inequality continues to grow, and that in order to be part of the top 1%, you need to be doing better than on average around about 7% per annum in the growth of your earnings in order to have any chance of catching up.
Mm.
And that is that is, you know, that's got to occur in an environment where wages have been rising by around about only 2% over that period of time. So when I looked at, well, what are the common themes of those people who are in the top 1%?
Okay.
There's a couple of common themes that tend to play out here in terms of those who make up the top 1%. Now, on average, number one, they get advice and have since before they were in the 1%.
Yeah.
Okay.
So from early on, they sought advice from professionals well before they were on high incomes. It enabled them to make good financial decisions, budget and invest and grow their incomes. And they had teams in place to help them grow their wealth.
Mm, so it's not always about what you earn.
No, not at all. And this comes down to a classic example of a client who I met probably around about 5 years ago. This guy was a postal delivery officer for Australia Post. Not educated, earning around about $56,000 a year. This is 5 years ago, so his income may have changed, but let's be honest, they don't get paid a lot doing that job. He was worth about $1.6 million net when I met him. He was about 45 years of age at the time, and he made his wealth on a wage of $56,000, or probably less, because that's what he was earning at that time.
Yeah.
And he'd made his wealth through just saving and investing, and he started off with a small property out in Sunshine, a single one-bedroom flat in Sunshine.
Mm.
He took that and bought his next property. He took those returns and bought his next property, took those returns again and bought his next property, and over the course of a 15-year period, at the time that I first met him, he was worth $1.6 million on a single income of $54,500. So
that's impressive.
Yeah. And he sought advice. He sought advice from property advisors, from his accountant. At the time, he didn't have a financial advisor, but you know, he didn't just do this on his own. He used professionals, and he gained their knowledge and leveraged off their experience to help him get started. Number two, they typically have multiple accounts. So instead of having one account where everything goes into and is paid from, they have numerous everyday accounts, credit cards, mortgages, they manage their money, and they manage their money between them. So this comes down to some of the principles that we speak about here at UGC when we're designing financial strategies, where you have your spending account, you have your everyday living account, you have your savings for later spending, you have your cash reserve account, and then you have your investment accounts. And you divide your income up into these different buckets, and you budget for those expenditures, and you try and live within your means. Now, you don't actually budget, but what we do is we have a cash flow allocation strategy. Yeah.
Try to set it on autopilot.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, number three, which I think is really quite important, because I see a lot of people who get themselves into financial stress have problems with this, and that is that they avoid debt on credit cards. They pay their credit cards off every month, and they can accrue points, but they don't accrue debt. Okay, the only debt that they carry tends to be for mortgages on their own homes or for investment properties.
Yeah, so the clear line between good debt and bad debt.
Correct. Mm. They own their own business. Okay,
yeah.
One of the greatest wealth creators that is out there is owning your own business. So they spent a few years learning what they needed to and working with others, with the business owners mentoring them. Then they branched out and spent a few years building their own business, and they still have mentors or circles for advice throughout that whole process. So very similar to pretty much most of us. We learnt our craft under the tutelage of somebody else. We then gained that experience and knowledge, and then we've gone out and started our own businesses, but we've always leveraged the advice and the experience of our mentors and our professional advisors to help us carry those businesses through. And they have a single focus as well. They're not chopping and changing careers. Each one has a single focus when it comes to their career or business, whether it be property, business, finance, medicine, or construction. They have all been dedicated to their industry from the beginning of their careers.
Mm.
They're not having career changes. They're using that power of compounding their knowledge and their wealth and their expertise into parlaying that into future success.
Reminds me of Warren Buffett's snowball scenario.
Snowball scenario?
Yeah, talks it about start with a very small snowball at the top of a mountain, get it rolling, it just continues to get bigger and bigger as it accumulates more snow on its way down. It takes time, but
Yeah.
There was a book about him, it was called The Snowball.
Oh, right.
Based on that, yeah.
Wow, there
Yeah.
So staying on the same track for a long time.
That's exactly right. Mm. So look, just some insights there that I thought would be interesting for our listeners to hear. And I hope that they can take something out of that.
Yeah. Mm. That's really good, Joel. Really good.
I knew you'd like it. It's very you that.
It is. It's very me. I'm gonna come in off the back of that with my topic for the day, but before I jump into that, we'll take a quick break. Beautiful. When it comes to default superannuation, we've seen this report on funds that are underperforming and funds that are outperforming. But for me, it's just promoting this stupid message of, oh, it's okay to not pay attention to your own super fund. The super system is doing the work for you and you can do nothing about it because we're protecting you. And every time I see a TV ad for a super fund, I see through it as this marketing pitch from the super fund saying, oh, leave your money with us, trust us to manage your money and be complacent, just do nothing and don't pay attention, we'll get these average returns for you. And it's a stupid message for anyone who actually pays attention to their money. Because you know you can do better than these average returns that average super funds generate. Now, the real message of what your super fund should be generating is in our investor guide. Go to ugc.net.au/investor guide to see an extra $300,000 at retirement and see what your super fund should really do. And we're back. I'm going to jump in off the back of Joel's conversation there. And what I want to talk about this week is at the point of decisions, what are some of the things that can hold us back? Because what Joel was saying was, the first point was about getting advice and using professional advisors leading towards making good decisions. And I wanted to talk about decisions today. When we're faced with a decision, often we look at two sides of it. We've got the question about, okay, if I make this change, if I make this decision and go ahead, what if it works? What might I gain if it works? And if we're looking at an investment decision, then we're looking at the potential returns. But then on the other side of it, we want to understand the risks. And if it doesn't work, then what might I lose from this? So it's a pretty binary decision if we consider those two factors. And where people can get a little stuck is the uncertainty between the two. So what's the likelihood of success and how much will that success be? What's the likelihood of the risk coming true and how much might the loss be? And what is that uncertainty and how am I going to deal with that uncertainty and the potential of the loss situation? But what I want to bring in is another consideration, because remembering that our decisions are not just logic-based, they are based on our emotions and how we feel at the time. I touched on something last week, which is, a couple of weeks ago, which is knowing yourself and knowing your own values and your own identity when you are making decisions about changing something. What I want to put in people's considerations today is if you're thinking about what if it works and what I might gain, also think about what if it works, what I might lose. If this pays off, what might you lose in the future from success? In a lot of people's worlds, have you guys heard of the term self-sabotage?
Yes.
Yes? Yes, yep.
Have you experienced it, or do you know other people that have experienced it?
Both.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
So you've noticed it in other people. And the concept is that for some subconscious reason, people are moving towards success, but then their own action or behavior cuts themselves down and then leads to their failure.
Mm.
And they end up going back to the situation that they started in. And it also enables them in a lot of cases to justify, oh, well, I tried to change, but it didn't work for me, so I'm just going to stay the same.
Mm.
So this is a situation where I see someone who's stuck and I'm thinking, hang on, you haven't considered what you might lose if it does work. So what are the things that you lose in success? Well, for some people, you lose the ability to complain about things. Who knows a complainer?
No. Oh, yeah.
Yeah? You're not thinking of anyone in
particular? No, no. Well, I am, but it's not the person who you're thinking of. Yeah.
We all know the complainers in our lives. Well,
maybe you do.
All right. So we all have these friends.
Yeah.
But they love to complain. They might not think they love to complain, but it's part of their makeup now. It's part of the person that they are. And if they'd actually try something new and it works, well, then they would lose that ability to complain.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you're going to see them sabotage their own efforts so that they can go back to complaining.
Mm-hmm.
For someone else, it might be a little more complicated. Here's another thing, which another concept that I have, which is the financial blueprint. Everyone has their financial history. In fact, everyone has their life history. Mm. And a lot of people's makeups in the way they think today comes from their childhood. So if you grew up in an environment where your parents didn't have a lot of money, now you've got a decision. Well, here's a way that I can make a lot of money. And subconsciously, we always look for the comfort of our childhood. Therefore, here's something which is going to make me more money, but that's going to take me away from my history or my parents' values, and I'm going to have some kind of guilt associated with that. So how do I break out of that? If you're not consciously aware of these factors, well, then it can lead to self-sabotage. Mm. And when it comes to making the decision, you think you're making a decision based on the logic decision and the risk associated, but actually you've got this subconscious drive to go back to what makes you comfortable in childhood or the situation that you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you decide not to change. You sabotage yourself and it leads to failure. So that's my theme for the day. I want people to consider what are the things that they need to let go of in order to make a decision towards success. Yes, there's always going to be risks. There's always going to be some uncertainty, but you can have the plans in place, and particularly with financial plans, we do have those plans in place to mitigate risks. What we can't plan for you is how you feel about yourself and how you see yourself, and you need to be aware of what are the things you need to let go of. I remember seeing an entrepreneur on stage, Damon John, the founder of
FUBU
Clothing, a huge hip-hop brand that just exploded in the late 80s, early 90s, and he's now...
Is FUBU still a thing these days? I haven't seen a lot of it around.
No, probably not.
Says our producer, Elaine, over here. No, definitely not.
He's more up with it than we are.
But
he made good bet.
He's now a billionaire. appears on the US version of the TV show Shark Tank, which is a panel of five entrepreneurs who assess contestants' business ideas. And he's got his fingers in a lot of pots. But one of the things he said was they really struggled because they grew up in this community. And then when he had financial success, he was completely alienated from that community.
Yeah.
Because he now had millions of dollars of wealth at the time.
He was now the lucky guy, was he?
Yeah. That's right. He was the lucky guy.
Didn't he get kissed on that?
So none of his friends had wealth. So his friend's perception of him changed.
Yeah.
And his partner really struggled.
Now he's got a big head.
His kids...
No, that's... I mean, he probably doesn't. No, but now everyone's going, Damon.
That's their perception.
Now he's got a big head.
That wealthy knob.
And this is in America where they really celebrate success and capitalism. They embrace that more than anyone else. In Australia, we've really got the tall poppy syndrome. So that can make it even harder to break out of this. So... I'll leave it at that for today. Consider what you might lose if you have success and whether you want to lose it and keep that as part of your decision making.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the key things around success that many successful people that I've listened to say is surround yourself with other people who are successful, because that will put you in an environment where it is okay to be successful and it will put you in an environment where it will help you to continue to strive.
Yeah.
And you support one another.
Yep.
So, something to think about.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, it's more than just learning from the people around you. It's the environment that you're in.
Yep.
And being comfortable with that.
Great. I think, Louis, the biggest challenge in my experience for people that are like you say, in an environment where they're surrounded with people, and as Joel alluded to, going to another one, is it's very hard for a person to be comfortable acting outside of what they identify themselves as.
Mm.
So if you're suddenly something different and it's not who you identify yourself at, you're going to be butting heads with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
To change that. So that's absolutely the big challenge.
Yeah, that's right. And and Brett, you'd have real experience with this, being a formal professional in sports.
Yeah, yeah. Career change was difficult because, you do something for a long time and it's all you know yourself as. So when you make a change, it took me a long time to feel comfortable that that's who I was and I was competent enough to own it.
Yeah,
It does take time. You can't just click your fingers and be done. Obviously, the decision to change comes quickly after a lot of, other things that drive you to it.
Mm.
But to actually own a new identity does take you a lot of time.
Sure does, sure does. All right, well, that was the best topic I've heard all day. Well done, Louis. You're great.
We're not done yet.
We'll kick on to a break and then we'll be back with Brett.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And here we are. We're back. And Brett, you've got some interesting news, some good news, really, for a lot of people.
Well, Louis, have you heard the saying, you can't keep a good man down?
I have?
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to slightly change that to saying, you can't keep a good market down.
Right.
Uh-huh. And the Australian property market is a good market.
Yeah.
And the signs are showing that that's the case even more now. Obviously, we've discussed on the podcast over the last 6 months or so about how it's declined over the last 18. Well, it had declined up until around June this year.
Yep.
And that sites where it would level off and start to increase. Well, the data is supporting that now. We're starting to see the flow on of all of the settled sales and auctions and everything coming through that shows that over the whole market across the country, property values are increasing on average. So it shows the market is recovering. Now, some data that further supports this is that the investor market's coming back.
Okay.
Now, what I mean by that is typically in the property market, the majority of purchasers are homeowners, people that are going to live in it, owner-occupiers.
Yep.
And the investor market has typically averaged around a third of that over the long term. But in the last couple of years, that's declined significantly, where a lot of the investors disappeared. Whether it was because they were nervous, lending standards changed, they couldn't find it. A lot of it was offshore offshore investors disappeared because they could no longer get access to it, or the the stamp duty and taxes became too high.
Yep.
But some data from CoreLogic just this week shows that the consecutive rate cuts combined with an easing in lending standards has seen a significant rise in investor lending in every state and territory recording a lift in the value of investment loans.
Wow.
So the investor market's coming back.
Okay.
So proportionately, investment activity is up. Now, like I said, roughly a third is the long-term average. So we're still a significant way below that, though. So below the long-term average of how many finance applications are for investment versus owner-occupiers.
Yep.
The change in the last few months has been a cumulative growth of 11.6% over the 3 months ending in August.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fastest rate of growth of the value of investment loans since November 2016.
Wow. Okay.
So that tells us that the investor market's coming back. Now, the long-term average, as I said, around one third. And let me see, there was one other stat I wanted to show here. Right, so the value of investment home loan commitments has increased by 19.1%.
Wow, okay.
So it shows that the investors are more willing and they're getting access to more money. So all these things that we've been discussing over the last few months of, easier lending, markets improving, it's starting to flow through with real data supporting that.
Yeah.
Now, combined with that, something that says that there's a good reason to be active investment is the supply-demand scenario.
Okay.
You know, we know that price growth is always driven by when demand outstrips supply.
Yes.
And price declines tend to happen when there's more supply than demand.
Mm-hmm.
So the residential construction downturn is now actually larger than the Reserve Bank expected.
Right.
Is it?
So building approvals are currently 40% lower than their 2017 peak.
Okay.
40%?
40%.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, we know we had a boom time and there was a lot of stuff being built in sort of 2016-17 and the flow on into 2018. But now the Reserve Bank are forecasting a further 7% decline in housing investment over the next year.
Jeez. Okay.
So they're then seeing that there's going to be quite a large shortfall in the foreseeable future. So if that is the case, and obviously there's not enough buildings being approved and therefore constructed, on the back of what they're seeing is significant population growth forecast to continue, they're indicating that all of this data is saying there's going to be an undersupply. If there's an undersupply, typically, what does that mean?
Yep.
Has to be an increase in pricing.
Yeah.
So it shows that the market's getting to a point where we should see growth. The investors are coming back, the lending's ease so that there's more people able to buy, and there's more population growth and less stock.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
There you go.
So it looks good for the foreseeable future from a property investment scenario.
Absolutely.
Mm.
And if everyone listens to this podcast and follows our advice, then there'll be more people moving into that top 20%.
Yes.
That'll drive more investors too.
Yep.
Yeah. Excellent. Oh, very interesting. And that's probably some welcome news for a lot of people who are holding properties that they live in or that they're invested in. Does that change when someone is looking at being an investor? Does that really change your outlook on things, Brett?
Explain what you mean by the question.
If someone said, "I'm ready to invest," if someone said to you 12 months ago, "I'm ready to be an investor,"
yep,
versus someone saying today, "I'm ready to be an investor," do you change your position much? Do you now get a lot more excited than you were 12 months ago?
Look, I try to take the emotion out of it as we talk about, because we want to make logical driven decisions with money, and a lot of that is based on our research and the data we're looking at. But as we've held a pretty firm line for a long time on what we believe are the reasons to invest in property, and that doesn't change with us.
Yeah.
So if we believe in the fundamentals that you're buying it for the long term, you know, if you manage your affairs well, you can hold it for the long term, so you're never going to be under financial stress and have to sell. That should put you in a position, providing you buy the right asset. Now, that's the critical thing. It's a matter of, yes, we want to be property investors, but not just a property investor. We want to be a property investor of a good quality property. So making sure we identify the right location and the right style of property and making sure our financial affairs in order. If we tick all of those boxes, I would enter the market at any time, because we will find an opportunity at any time that makes sense.
Yeah. There's a bull market somewhere.
There is always, because we're, you know, and we've pushed this point repeatedly here. There's not just one Australian property market. I've spruiked data today. Well, I've outlined data today. I don't want to use the word spruik. But I've used data today that's talking about the Australian residential property market as a whole. Now, that's not the case. You can never have it as a whole, but the data's always bundled together to give us that information.
Mm.
So at any point in time, I believe there will be markets that you would want to be moving into and some that you maybe wouldn't even consider.
Yeah.
If you're in the ones that we wouldn't consider, that doesn't mean they're bad. It just means you need to be there for the longer term.
Yeah.
So at any point in time, I think we could find you an opportunity that makes sense.
Brett, that data that you spruiked Australia-wide, it matches what we've talked about before. I remember in the last 6 to 12 months, we've been critical of regulators using the lending standards policy and the high assessment rates to really drive out the investor in the market. And you and Joel have been critical of using a higher assessment rate. So we really saw that at the time.
Mm.
So now for the Reserve Bank to say, oh, well, the property activity has declined more than we expected, well, you're not looking very hard, are you?
No.
They're
always slow.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to tweak the dials that they believe.
Yep.
But, you know, the market will dictate what's really going on.
Yeah, that's right. And we knew that investors were finding it more difficult because of the restrictions on interest-only lending from the banks and the higher interest rates that investors were paying just because it was an investor loan,
mm-hmm.
which is still the case today, but the margin of difference has shrunk.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's...
Well, you just reminded me, Luke, and I think we highlighted this probably 6 or 7 months ago. There was a big lull. It was almost like a flat spot. And a lot of it we forecast was as the reason it was going to be a flat spot because there was uncertainty about the outcome of the Royal Commission. That was just starting to come through. And the election was pending.
Yeah,
so
true.
We sort of knew that people were going to be sitting on their hands for a while. And once those two outcomes were known and things started to be implemented.
And throw in there a couple of interest rate
cuts. So, you know, I would actually say that what's happening right now is pretty much exactly what we said would happen.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm not saying that because, I mean, yes, we are good at what we do, but it was pretty easy to see that coming.
Yeah. If come on,
you knew
mate,
what
take
to look
some
at.
Credit.
Yeah, well, we do our research and analysis pretty well. But I would actually say if we could go back to one of those podcasts 6 or 7 months ago, I think we called pretty much this scenario.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty sure we did. You heard it here first on the Investor Exchange. Mm.
I was actually just thinking, I heard his name this morning, Nick Kyrgios. Now, it's not that you can't be serious with him, but I'm thinking Super Mac was always the biggest brat, but Kyrgios has to have taken over now, doesn't he? Maybe we've got to find him with a big out, something he says to replace a bit more current.
Do you think, though, that we look back on McEnroe and we see he was a bona fide legend of
the
sport,
that's the difference.
Do we look back at Kyrgios and say he was a bona fide legend?
He hasn't won anything
of
significance.
Exactly.
No,
He's never been the competitor that Super Mac was.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And he deliberately used it as a tactic to get over his opposition, didn't he?
Yeah, there was more to him.
Very good. All right, what have you got for us?
Well, look, I'm going to rattle off two today, if I can hog the mic for a little bit longer. One of them is purely because it's property related. I saw an article on a property that sold recently for a $75,000 loss, so not great. But the part I was stunned at was it was a mortgagee sale of a home that had been on the market for some time. And it sold, it's 1,000 square meters, it's in a regional area, but it sold for as little as $97,000.
Wow.
Whoa.
So as someone that obviously looks at the markets and sees house prices, I'm not too sure there's anywhere else in Australia you could buy a house on 1,000 square meters of property for $97,000.
Right. Whereabouts was that?
Port Lincoln, South Australia.
Lincoln. Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, so obviously a regional area with, you know, not a whole lot of industry,
fishing mainly,
but it's still an area that has, not like it's a four house town or something.
No, you can't build a house for $97,000, let alone the land.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and it was bought for $173,000 in 2004.
Ooh,
so there's an indication of a property investment gone backwards.
Ooh, yeah.
So I thought that was, something you can't
see. Oh, my goodness.
But the main one for the week is to do a throwback to something Joel brought up roughly a year ago. And one of the biggest, ways you can, I've lost my train of thought with the word here, but I guess give kudos to someone is to replicate them.
Yes.
Imitate.
That's
imitation is the best form of flattery.
That's what I was looking for. So copycats out there. Now, unbelievably, there's a copycat poo jogger.
Oh, God.
It's back.
It's back. So avid listeners may remember Joel brought it to our attention around a year ago of the poo jogger a CEO in Brisbane that was running around dropping some logs.
Was it a Veo group? A Veo?
I think so.
I don't want to go out there and get slapped with a defamation case.
And actually, Douglas McIntosh, his name's online, so you could look him up. So he was a member of Brisbane Council Advisory Board as well. So a quite well-to-do person running around
taking care of their
whilst he's jogging.
Plans.
Yeah. But there's a new one in Sydney now. So there's the copycat poo jogging now. Caught on camera.
I think I saw this.
Yeah, it's been in the news quite a bit because... The area that she's doing it is right out the front of Roxy Jacenko's house. People familiar with Roxy Jacenko, a celebrity?
I know of her. Yeah.
Know of her, yeah. I'm not 100%. Yeah. I know the name. I know she's famous for being famous to some degree.
Famous for being famous, and she's married to...
That's right. She was married to a guy who went to jail.
Went to jail for insider trading.
That's it. Yeah, so she's on record for finding it and saying, one is fair enough, but four or five I think is too much.
One is fair enough? Okay. Wow. Well, here's some relationship behaviour, which is a little bit subpar, frankly quite dumb. A man who is worried about his girlfriend walking home in the dark from the train station. Fair-founded fear. He was concerned for her. It was actually an hour walk from the train station to home dark. So okay. It's a long
walk. Yeah, very long.
He offered to pick her up or pay for a taxi for her to come home, but it was happening every day. And she was even calling him on the way home saying, oh, I'm just a bit worried, you know, shadows, it's dark, but no, don't come and pick me up. So he took matters into his own hands by hiding in the bushes.
Oh, you joke.
And jumping out at her.
Oh, no.
And giving her a right fright.
That would have gone down well.
So, yeah, did not go down well. Mm. He went to the internet saying, am I being unreasonable here? Am I being the dick for, you know, jumping out at a bush at her? And the internet says,
yes.
Yes, you're an asshole. Yeah, you don't jump out at bushes scaring people. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. So, there you go. What an asshole boyfriend.
Well, a new study has come out that has shown that the stock market shows greater reaction to forecasts by analysts with favorable surnames. Oh, so, in fact, investors tend to treat the stock market predictions of some analysts better than analysts who have different types of surnames.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you pick what the distinction would be?
A forename with money?
No. Money?
You would think so.
The Big Short, and Ryan Gosling says, of course he's right. Of course he's smart, because he's Asian.
Exactly.
He's good at math.
Is this where it's going?
Unfortunately, though, it builds into some of our prejudices as well. Yeah, so researchers have found that following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, market reactions weakened for forecasts from analysts with Middle Eastern names, surnames. And they also found that following the French and German government's opposition to the US-led Iraq war, US market reactions weakened for analysts with French or German surnames.
Sacre bleu.
So this effect was stronger in firms with lower institutional ownership and for analysts with non-American first names. So obviously these are the retail investor reactions who might have some form of bias.
More prone to bias.
Yeah.
Mm.
Wow. Jeez. Wow.
Yeah.
There we go.
I think of the newspaper sometimes they even have a headshot and I was thinking, oh, maybe the ones with glasses look smarter. So,
Is that what I'm doing wrong?
There you go. If that's what you're paying attention to as an investor, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us again this week, listeners.
There's a reason why they call them dumb money and smarter money.
There you go. Thanks for listening again, listeners. We'll be back again next week. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to The Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.